if you could, tell us maybe the origins of getting involved with this project about Frederick Law Olmsted.
This project goes back for me more than 36 years. I was doing a film on Boston's water supply, and I came across Olmsted, who designed the Emerald Necklace, which is Boston's major park system. And I kept stumbling over him, and I didn't know much about him. And then as I did more 19th century history films, I came to really appreciate how profound his influence was in American society. And I brought the idea to WNED Buffalo, and they said, hey, we've been thinking about him for 30 years, too. And I said, well, let's collaborate on this. I'd already done two major films with WNED, one on Niagara Falls and one on the War of 1812. So this is a natural extension of that. The reason that Buffalo, that WNED was so interested is that Olmsted is a huge, huge person in Buffalo's history. Not only in the city of Buffalo, but Niagara Falls and upstate New York and western New York particularly. So you can see the national influence of Olmsted just by looking at Buffalo. So it was the perfect collaboration.
Let's talk about that national influence, because as I was reading through some of the information regarding this, I see he was involved with Yosemite. He's involved with Central Park. He was involved in Boston, obviously here in Buffalo as well. I would say maybe until maybe the last 10 or 15 years with the Olmsted Parks Conservancy emerging here on the scene, he was generally forgotten here in Buffalo. What about that role nationwide? Is he generally a forgotten figure?
Well, he was a forgotten figure for a long time, and that's because other people took over from him. He laid the groundwork for landscape architecture in the United States. He created the term. The term didn't exist before that, and it was his son, just a few years before Olmsted died, who founded the Landscape Architecture School at Harvard, and that morphed into a combination of landscape architecture and urban planning. So other people took on the mantle. And designed in his style and in his name and his philosophy. And then in about 1980 or so, people started to appreciate it and rediscover him. And in fact, Buffalo had something to do with that as well. That story is that in Atlanta, there was a Olmsted Park that was threatened with a highway that was going to destroy the park. And the people there went down to City Hall to see what they could find out about its history, and they saw the name Olmsted. And they said, oh, well, let's see if we can find out about Olmsted. And someone directed them to Charlie Beveridge, who's an Olmsted scholar. And he said, hey, don't let them do to Atlanta what they did to Olmsted in Buffalo, which is take up the Humboldt Parkway and turn it into the Kensington Expressway and destroy one of the most beautiful parkways in America. So Olmsted actually had a profound influence on park protesters, preservationists in Atlanta, and the park preservation movement has spread across the United States.
I'm so glad that you brought up that movement, because we do continue to see that here in Western New York. Front Park, which was his design, is right next to the Peace Bridge. The Peace Bridge expansion has been a huge issue here, and so obviously we have that I guess what is considered to be an economic progressive move against a preservation move. And sometimes people don't see eye to eye on these things. And I'm kind of curious, maybe going back to his origins, Olmsted's, when he was trying to design these massive parks, I think of Central Park in New York City, did he run into those same type of issues when he was designing these parks as well? That people said, oh, no, you can't set aside that park for public consumption. We need it for private concerns.
Yes, this is always the tension. But Olmsted was lucky enough to have been invited to work on Central Park when it wasn't his idea. The idea of setting aside the land came first, and then he was hired as the superintendent. The reason he was hired as a superintendent, because he had friends in high places who got him a job. He was desperate for a job. He had failed at five or six professions by the time he got to Central Park. But those professions all led him to the landscape architect that he became. Those other professions were farmer, or surveyor, sailor, and almost most importantly, reformer and writer. He was actually famous for a while as the writer of a series of over 50 articles about the economics of slavery in the South. And just want to leap ahead a century. Malcolm X credits some of his radicalization with having read Olmsted while he was in prison. So Olmsted, his tentacles reach far and wide.
He really, now that you get into it, I'm kind of curious about that personality that you've gotten to know, obviously so very very well. And obviously his influence is upon landscape architecture, but he seems like a classic, almost Renaissance man.
Yes, yes, he was, and he was kind of an autodidact. You know that I mean, he was self-educated. He spent a few semesters in at Yale, but he had very poor eyesight. He had to drop out. But he became a good writer, and he associated himself with the Transcendentalists. So when he gets hired by the New York Times to be their first foreign correspondent, and the foreign country being the U.S. South, he already has a reputation. He goes on to help found the Nation magazine and Putnam's Weekly, none of which can pay him very well. Mm. So Olmsted is driven by a couple of things. One is he needs to make money to feed his family. And the other is he sees himself as a great reformer. Everything he does has philosophy behind it. He believes that parks can actually change and shape people. The reason we associate Olmsted with preservation is that at one point when he's actually running a gold mine in Mariposa, California, he's tapped to be on a commission to look into what to do with the Yosemite Valley, which was just being considered for either development or a park. And that's where he first starts to write about the reason to preserve these places, to set them aside, about how they affect the mind. And later when he comes back to Buffalo, he works for 10 years intensely to save Niagara Falls, and he creates the Goat Island Reservation, the Niagara Falls State Reservation there, which becomes one of the first places set aside in the United States, which leads directly to the Forever Wild Clause in the New York State Constitution, which leads directly to the formation of the National Park Service, which then leads to the Forest Service, which then leads to the Wilderness Act in 1964. So you can trace a lot of our scenic beauty in the United States to Olmsted's philosophy and efforts.
I'm fascinated by Olmsted, but I also want to get into some of the elements of the film itself as well. I see that in this particular release I'm reading, I see author Adam Gopnik is quoted. So am I safe to assume that he is also one of the individuals that we're going to hear from throughout the movie?
Yeah, Adam Gopnik's in the film. He's one of my favorite writers. Mm-hmm. A well-known New Yorker writer, and the reason we have him in the film is that he wrote a lot about Olmsted, and his perspective on Olmsted is from somebody who lived in France for a long time. Gopnik lived in France for a long time, and when he comes back to the United States, he writes quite a few essays about the difference between an Olmsted park and a French park, and that really gets to the heart of what Olmsted is doing when he first starts working on parks, because parks traditionally were the province of the royalty, and in New York City, where we didn't have royalty, you had barons who had set up their own fiefdoms, and there are still locked, gated parks in New York City. And Olmsted believed the park should be open to the people, and that they had the salutary effect. In fact, he goes so far as when he designed Central Park to put a dairy in the park, so that poor women can come there and get fresh milk for their children. I mean, this is really a leap from just having a pleasant place to hang out to saying we need to make it a place that's not only safe for women, but where they can have food for their children.
I also see listed in here gorgeous cinematography, creative animation, compelling commentary. But I'm curious about the creative animation part. Can maybe just give us a little taste of what that's going to be like?
Yeah, we work with a wonderful animator named Amit Sethi, who we've been working with for about 10 or 15 years. And one of the reasons we had to use animation in this film is not because there wasn't stuff to show, but because the plans that Olmsted did are so intricate and beautiful, you want to make them come alive. And those plans, as you see in the film, they move around, they twist and turn, you sweep over them. So you get a real sense of the movement that Olmsted wanted to have. When people talk about Olmstedian, you know, they use this phrase, that park is Olmstedian. One of the things they're talking about is this feeling of movement in a park. So when you animate the design, you can go from that movement over the design into the park and get a sense of it. And I want to say one more thing about that movement. Olmsted really believed that a park should not be static, that when you go through a park, it reveals something and it's full of surprises. So there's certain classic elements in an Olmsted park that you recognize right away. When you see a serpentine path that goes into a copse, so, you know, a bit of woods, then opens up into another area, and then an archway that opens up into a sort of a surprise vista, that's Olmstedian. When you see that there's not a regimentation of flowers, and sometimes what's Olmsteady is the absence of something, and there's no regimentation in an Olmsted Park. He wants it to appear natural. Now, I use that word appear very carefully because Olmsted engineered all the parks. New York Central Park and Prospect Park are the most famous of the engineered parks, but all of them are engineered in some way. Delaware Park in Buffalo was one of the least engineered because it was already beautiful. He didn't have to do that much to it. But if he saw a piece of land that he felt needed to be improved aesthetically, he was not shy about ripping it up completely, putting in lakes and drainage and woods and building bridges, especially even if a bridge wasn't necessary, because he had an aesthetic ideal. But he also believed that if a place was beautiful, natural, and functioned naturally, then leave it alone. So those two things, it can sound like they're in conflict. And in the film, there is this sense of conflict because we talk about how Olmsted was like Disney. And one of our interviewees says that people bridle at that. They don't want to hear the words Disney and Olmsted in the same sentence. But, you know, what does Disney do? He attracts millions and millions of people and makes them happy. In fact, there's this famous story about Disney's father working as a laborer at the Chicago World's Fair. Olmsted designed the landscape of the Chicago World's Fair. So think about this great World's Fair with all these lights and flashing. You know, it's all electrified with those big lagoons and beautiful boats floating through it. And can you imagine Disney's father telling him about it? And then Disney building, you know, the two Disney World and Disneyland, and tracing that, you know, back to Olmsted. You know, it's a wonderful connection.
And then finally, I think there's a lot of lessons inside this for modern society in terms of valuing its parks and making sure that certain public areas are set aside. That I guess is somewhat obvious and will probably be borne out just a little bit more in the presentation. But I'm curious more about the man himself and maybe lessons that he could offer the modern person. When, you know, because I always find these types of figures, they're so larger than life, and they bring such brilliance. Obviously, his brilliance is seen across the country. Well, what about that? Lessons that he could offer us today.
One of the great things about Olmsted is he doesn't declare himself a landscape architect until he's 42 years old.
Okay.
And a friend of mine said to me, "That means there's hope for my son. Maybe he'll find himself." You know, but Olmsted is about 36 years old when he starts working in Central Park, and then it's another 6 years before he says, "Okay, now I can be a professional." But he gives up on it for a while. He works in during the Civil War. He's the head of the Sanitary Commission, the precursor to the Red Cross. And then he fights with his bosses there. He goes out and becomes a head of a gold mine, but the gold mine goes bankrupt. And he comes back to landscape architecture. And I think here the lesson is that you don't just because you fail at something. Just because you might not be perfect at it right away, just because you don't always get along with people, he stuck to his ideals, he stuck to his principles, and he did persevere. And he becomes very successful later on, not super rich, but his name has a lot of value. His name has so much value that he changes the name of his son, Henry, his only natural son. He adopted his brother's wife's children. He marries his brother's wife, but he changes his son's name from Henry to Frederick Law Olmsted Jr. And he says to him, as is in the film, "I don't have a lot of money. All I can give you is my name." And then Frederick Law Jr. conveniently drops the junior. And, you know, I think it's really funny is that Olmsted's born in 1822, and Frederick Law Jr. is working until 1957. And people still think he's the original Frederick Law. You know?
Well, there's another lesson there, but I think that one's a little more obvious. Well, very good. Larry Hodge, sounds like you've got a winner, and we're looking forward to seeing it. Bye-bye.
All right, bye-bye.